At the end of a chapter titled Down to the Country in his new book Ping Pong Diplomacy, Nicholas Griffin characterizes the achievement of two national table tennis teams in 1971 as the single greatest foreign policy feat of the century. Nicholas Griffin joins me from WLRN in Miami. And Mr. Griffin, I know I'm jumping into the middle of the story by starting with that assertion, but remind us of the impact of ping pong diplomacy almost 45 years ago.
Ping pong diplomacy arrived at this moment where the ground between the Chinese and America seemed absolutely frozen. There'd been no communication in 22 years. And so this invitation that seemed totally spontaneous transformed everything overnight when the Chinese asked the Americans if they'd like to visit Beijing for a week. They had to make up their minds in 24 hours. They found themselves standing in the middle of Tiananmen Square within 48 hours, and the rest is history.
Your book begins with the introduction of Ivor Montague, an Englishman, and as you write, Mr. Montague, who was born to wealth, I'm quoting now, understood that his class offered a thick smokescreen of protection. What did this ping-pong enthusiast who eventually became head of the sport's international governing body need protection from?
Well, he was a very odd character. He was born into one of the wealthiest families in England. His father was Baron Swathling. The house was always filled with home secretaries and foreign ministers and prime ministers and even the Princess of Wales. So he met all of them. But he was, from a very young age, as a teenager, a socialist and then a communist. And despite having a very normal, open life where he was, for instance, producing all of Hitchcock's spy movies, he worked first for the Comintern, which was the Communist International, as a spy. And then he graduated during the Second World War to be one of the GRU's spies. And the GRU was sort of Russian military intelligence. And that, of course, was as more important than the KGB when it came to wartime Russia. Who on earth would presume that a man who came from such a sort of a velvet suit background could possibly be a spy for the Soviet Union?
And beyond all that, a man whose true passion was ping pong.
That's right. I mean, he had several passions, but ping pong was definitely the most steady of them, well, probably alongside communism. Those were his two great loves. He started playing when he was a kid. He set up Cambridge and Oxford's first ever university match. He then founded the English Table Tennis Association, and right after that, the International Table Tennis Association. But by that time, he was already a member of the Communist International. And one of their ideas and why they existed was to try and use any form of culture as a way to get communism moving inside foreign borders. Mm. So he used his film career to do that, and then he also used his ping pong career.
This is the sort of thing, of you can't make this stuff up. You know, ping pong is a subversive activity.
Highly subversive.
To most people, the term ping pong diplomacy calls up images of the U.S. team visiting China and the Chinese team visiting the U.S. while Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger looked on approvingly. But tell us a little about various episodes of ping pong diplomacy occurring well before 1972.
Well, I suppose it all starts when Montague, within weeks of Mao winning the Chinese Civil War and taking power, Montague's already writing letters saying, why don't you guys pick ping pong as your national sport? He then got on a plane and goes out there very early on, and they listened to him. And I mean, I presume it's because they must have felt very comfortable knowing that they had a communist spy in charge of an international sporting body. But there was also this need for the Chinese to win at something and win at something quickly as a way to show that new China was getting onto its feet. And one of the great favors he did them was in 1961, during the Great Leap Forward, he offered Beijing the chance to host the World Championships. And this was, of course, a tremendously important year because the Great Leap Forward had turned out not to be great and not much of a leap forward. And by this time, there were millions dead. Even, you know, it depends who you ask, but it's somewhere between 17 and 35 million had starved to death in those previous 3 years. While the rest of the nation wasn't doing so well, the athletes had been treated like, you know, comparatively like kings and queens and fed extremely well. Even when the food ran out, they sent their shooting team into the deserts to go and shoot goats and bring back meat for the team.
Two of the most significant figures in the story of ping pong diplomacy are Zhuang Zetung, one of China's strongest players, and Glenn Cowan of the U.S. team. Tell us a little about their relationship.
It's a fascinating one because it's not built on much. The famous story goes, and you're supposed to believe this one, is that they meet when Glenn Cowan is leaving a practice arena at the World Championships in Nagoya, and there's a bus there, and he just happens to get on this bus. The doors close. He pulls away, and suddenly he realizes he's on the Chinese national team bus. It's a lovely story, but it's, you know, I don't believe it's true. I think the Chinese were waiting for him. He had been looked at very steadily earlier in the week. They thought they'd found someone who was overtly friendly, and Chuang Tse-Tung, being the best player in China, was the man who was supposed to deliver that message. So there's no real friendship. There's not enough time for friendship in a way between them.
Both Tse-Tung and Cowan were celebrated for a time. Tse-Tung climbed the ranks of the party hierarchy in China, and Cowan appeared on magazine covers and on TV programs back in the U.S. What accounted for the bad ends to which both of them eventually came?
Well, I think the answer in short is ping pong. Cowan thought that he had been part of this extraordinary moment. True. He thought he had a lot to do with it. Probably not so true. And he thought he was going to bring back this amazing wave of enthusiasm and that ping pong was going to become somewhere in between popularity between baseball and golf kind of thing. And, of course, it didn't. Ping pong had this wonderful month, and then it crept back into the sort of basement and the frat houses. And the poor guy never recovered. And, I mean, unfortunately, it's a very sad story where every April he would suffer from mental health issues, the same time of year when he first went to China. Mm. And he ended up homeless on the streets of Los Angeles, and he died at a young age. And then Chuang Tse-Tung had a very different story defined by ping pong, where he had this great time. Mao Tse-Tung regarded him as both a fantastic player and a fantastic diplomat. He was elevated into the National People's Congress and into the Central Committee. He was a favorite of Mao's wife during the last years of the Cultural Revolution. And when she fell after Mao's death, he fell too. Mm. People thought he'd been executed. He'd actually been locked up in solitary for 2 years, but his wife and his child had no idea. And he eventually emerged and was sort of partially forgiven and had to resume life in a different city as a street sweeper.
Nicholas Griffin is the author of Ping Pong Diplomacy. It's published by Scribner. Nicholas, thank you very much for speaking with me. This has been most instructive.
Thanks so much. Enjoyed it.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The Music Emporium, for 45 years offering collectible boutique and vintage acoustic guitars. TheMusicEmporium.com. And Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel. Now at Radio Shack. This is NPR.
In the recording business, there are big hits, and then there are really big hits. The biggest, at least in terms of vinyl records, is a spinning disc that's 407 feet in diameter and spins at 17 miles per hour. The record-breaking record was built from over 250,000 square feet of printed vinyl. It's a replica of the multi-platinum platter Hotel California, released by the Eagles nearly 40 years ago. The giant disc spins atop the newly renovated Forum concert venue where the Eagles have been performing. Sort of. I mean, at least some of them must be pretty old by now, don't you think? They could check out any time, and, like, then I guess they'd have to leave.